You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
I'm Aryeh Nair. I'm president of the Open Society Institute, and I'm very pleased to welcome you here this evening. I'm going to very briefly introduce the participants and then just say a few words about this event. Let me introduce them, starting from my right. Juan Mendez is the president of the International Center for Transitional Justice, and was my longtime colleague at Human Rights Watch, and my own earliest conversations about the significance of accountability for human rights abuses were my conversations at Human Rights Watch with Juan Mendez. Sitting next to Juan is Caitlin Riga, who is the deputy director of the prosecution program at the International Center for Transitional Justice, and she is a co-author of the book that we will be discussing this evening, Prosecuting Heads of State, or co-editor. And sitting next to her is Ellen Lutz, who was also my colleague at Human Rights Watch, and today is the executive director of Cultural Survival, and with Caitlin Riga, the co-editor of Prosecuting Heads of State. And then to Ellen's right is Scott Horton, an attorney who has been deeply involved in all of the public debates over abuses of human rights in connection with counterterrorism efforts by the Bush administration, as well as many other human rights matters. He's also a contributing editor at Harper's and a lecturer at Columbia Law School and Hofstra Law School. We are marking the publication of Prosecuting Heads of State. I don't know that we'll get to the point of prosecuting a former head of state in the United States for human rights abuses, but as one who was involved in the debates 35 years ago about the question of whether Richard Nixon should be prosecuted for violations of rights, I would note that this topic isn't entirely strange to the United States. At this moment, of course, we've had the recent conviction of Alberto Fujimori in Peru, the first time I believe that a head of state who was elected democratically was convicted and sentenced to a long prison term for human rights abuses committed during his presidency. I think that marks significant development in the prosecution of heads of state. But as the book points out, and as the authors will discuss, there have been a truly remarkable number of cases in recent years in which heads of state and former heads of state have been prosecuted and are being prosecuted for human rights abuses and for corruption. I think it has a lot to do with the degree to which the international human rights movement for the last quarter of a century has focused on the question of accountability for gross abuses for human rights. But the authors will have more to say on why this is taking place in this period. I think it is an immensely important development. The book is path-breaking I think it provides us with insights and information that we have not obtained elsewhere. So if you haven't yet obtained a copy, I hope you will do so. Do we have copies for sale here? Good. So I hope you'll take advantage of the opportunity to buy a copy. At any rate, at this point, let me turn the microphone over to Juan Mendez for brief comments.
Thank you very much. On behalf of the International Center for Transitional Justice, I'm very grateful to ARIE and to the Open Society Institute for this opportunity to launch and to present a book that that I think is truly remarkable for us, and that we hope that will have a significant impact in our debates in the United States and elsewhere about the access to justice by victims of human rights violations. I also want to thank the United States Institute of Peace for having had the original idea with Ellen Lutz to bring this project, to support the project, and then Ellen to bring it to our attention at ICTJ. Of course, I also want to thank Cambridge University Press for the immense honor that they make us in publishing the book and promoting it. We're very, very pleased that a very prestigious publishing house like Cambridge University Press is willing to publish this. I also want to thank Scott Horton for agreeing to introduce some comments today. We're very admiring of all his work that he has been doing, both as a lawyer, but also as a journalist on issues of accountability for human rights violations. It's a great pleasure for me to thank Ellen for having brought the idea to us. Like Aria said, all three of us were at one time working together in Latin America and on what we now call transitional justice issues, but that at that time we called accountability and had a very difficult time translating it into Spanish. I remember that Ellen was one of the first ones to bring to my attention that at the very least victims should have access to reparations for what they had endured. Since then, reparations, of course, has become a great part of our work. It has become very well established as part of the transitional justice canon, if you will. But even then, we thought that reparations by themselves would not be enough, that for certain types of crimes that reach the level of crimes against humanity or war crimes, the remedy has to include a thorough examination and investigation of the facts and of those giving the orders and those executing them, and an appropriate prosecution with all due regard for fair trial guarantees, but a prosecution of all those who might be responsible for them. It's a great pleasure for me and my colleagues, several of them here, to acknowledge that the work that Caitlin Reiger has done on this. As part of our prosecution's team, Caitlin has been very involved in the different kinds of activities that our prosecution's team conducts in support of international justice initiatives, but also bringing it down to the obligations of the state towards the victim and towards the events themselves. And that's why, for us, this book is particularly important, because even where we support the International Criminal Court and ad hoc tribunals and hybrid or mixed tribunals, wherever they are necessary, we always do it with the perspective that sooner or later the states have to live up to their responsibility to provide access to justice to the victims of the most serious human rights abuses, and to provide access to justice to the society when it comes to corruption issues. In that sense, then, this book exemplifies not only what must be done, But it also shows how difficult it is to prosecute and punish heads of state or the equivalent of heads of state, very high-ranking senior officials in any past government. It is difficult, but it's also possible. And the Fujimori case that Ari referred to gives us a very important example of how, in spite of all the difficulties and the resource constraints that a judiciary like the Peruvian judiciary has, it is not only possible but essential to conduct a trial for very complicated human rights cases with the most complete respect for due process of law and for the guarantees that the defense has to have, and yet to conclude it with an exemplary decision like the one we have witnessed only a few days ago. I have to say, however, that our insistence on prosecuting heads of state is important because we always want to single out those bearing the highest responsibility for the violations. But we should be always aware that it's not enough to punish the person most responsible for human rights violations, those who followed illegitimate orders, knowing that they were illegitimate, and those who executed them should also be punished, because otherwise we lose sight of the rules set forth at Nuremberg, that obedience to orders when it comes to manifestly illegal orders and when there's no moral choice, when there is a moral choice, available to the perpetrator of the order, is not an excuse and should not be an excuse. Again, thank you very much for being here. I think this is a very auspicious way of launching our book, and I want to thank especially Caitlin and Ellen, but all the authors of the book for a publication that makes ICTJ very proud. Thank you.
Thank you, Juan. Ellen, I believe you're going to lead off in talking about the book and about some of the findings.
Thank you very much. Well, first, let me share, as Juan and Arye did, my...
Pull the microphone a little closer to you.
Is that better?
Yeah.
Works fine? All right. I want to, as Arye and Juan both did, thank all of the panelists here and tell you what an honor it is to be sharing this table with them. It's especially an honor for me that to be here with two of the three of the great mentors of the early years outside of law school of my professional life. And Juan was one of the first people I met when I walked in the door at Amnesty International to begin working on these kinds of issues in the 70s. And then a decade later, Arye believed in me and hired me at Human Rights Watch, and I had the extraordinary opportunity of not only working with Juan again, but with Arye and with all of the team there. And it is from that portion of my career that the kernels of this book began to sort of rise out of the ground, but it's a tree now. I mean, it's a big project, and I'll start by saying that when I took a hiatus after leaving Amnesty to go to law school, and when I graduated, the third of my three mentors was Paul Hoffman, who's a human rights litigator in Los Angeles, and the first lawsuit that I got involved with, I was actually filing the lawsuit, was a Filarda-type case involving the violations of human rights of Ferdinand Marcos on behalf of three victims. And it was Paul who led me, in the old English way of doing things, through this process, because I obviously had no experience as a litigator, and he was brilliant. And but that case also very much molded my thinking, because while most of the victims in the Marcos litigation and the witnesses and their families and the organizations that had supported them were in the Philippines, Marcos's golden parachute dropped him in Hawaii. And that was beyond the long-arm reach of both Philippine criminal and civil law. If justice was to be done for any of Marcos's victims, there was no other forum, and the only option was reparation. But during the dozen or so years that the Marcos case wended its way through U.S. courts, the absence of those who most hungered for justice was constantly felt. Indeed, the case was just winding down as the nations of the world readied themselves for the Rome Conference that drafted the statute for the International Criminal Court. I went to Rome as part of Human Rights Watch's delegation, and unlike many of my NGO colleagues, was relieved when the complementarity provisions in the statute assured that the new tribunal would only try cases when the states were unwilling or unable to prosecute. And whereas my colleagues were fearing that the consequences of no justice, my experience had me equally concerned about attempts at justice that were disconnected from the people and the legal systems that were most invested with the need for justice. It was that experience that really led to the beginning of this particular project and this book. I knew that when I started, that prior to the trials of the colonels in Greece and the three juntas in Argentina, the vast majority of trials of top government officials had been staged events designed to give the imprimatur of legitimacy to political power grabs. But what I didn't appreciate was the extent to which the human rights movement, embrace of accountability then or transitional justice now, had led not only to the creation of the ICC, but to a quiet revolution within countries and regions that embrace the rule of law. In short, what I never expected was that today, 20 years after the end of the Cold War, I could report to you that nearly 70 heads of state from 47 countries have been brought before randomly chosen judges in judiciaries that are relatively independent of the politicians and political forces holding power for crimes that they committed while in office. That figure is just for heads of state or government. Had Caitlin and I looked at a larger subset of officialdom, as Professor Catherine Sitkink is now doing, we would have seen a much, much larger number of defendants, though mostly prosecuted in the same locales. My task today is to share with you the findings of our data. We have two parts to this book. One is a data set where we actually look at all the cases of ex-heads of state that have been indicted in, or depending on the legal system, the equivalent, and brought before judges at the beginnings of a case. So that's the complete data set. And then we have eight chapters which are written by experts who were on the ground, in the courtrooms, and in the communities, in the countries where the trials were taking place, or in the international processes where the trials were taking place. So the book has is kind of bookended by the data that we were able to pull together comprehensively. And then we asked experts who are actually there to write the individual case chapters. So my task is to talk about the data, and Caitlin will talk about the lessons that go deeper, that grew out of the cases. So the data, the basis of the findings, we looked at both human rights crimes, but also corruption and other financial crimes, which not surprisingly often go hand in hand. And while international clamor is stronger for human rights trials than for corruption trials, states considering trying a senior political figure frequently find that it's politically easier to do so for financial crimes than for human rights crimes. One reason is that corruption can be committed by an individual or a family or a group of cronies without much outside help, whereas human rights and humanitarian law crimes tend to implicate far larger numbers of people. In addition, corruption is a crime that infects an entire population more or less equally, whereas human rights crimes tend to target specific subpopulations. Thus, corruption trials are less likely than human rights trials to create or exacerbate social schisms within the society. Both Milosevic and Pinochet lost some or all of their political cachet when it came to light, for example, that they were engaged in widespread self-dealing. In both cases, their governments were far more eager to try them for corruption than humanitarian or human rights law crimes. Our data revealed that both democracy and the rule of law are positively correlated with state willingness to try leaders for both types of crimes. The more consolidated democratic norms are, the more consolidated what we call the justice norm, or the willingness of a state to try alleged criminals, irregardless of their rank or political power, is likely to be. 3/4 of the countries that indicted former heads of state are Democratic, as measured by Freedom House's 2007 Freedom in the World report, whereas only around half of the countries in the world are Democratic when measured by the same criteria. Of course, the correlation is not perfect. The case we always think of immediately when we say that is Spain, which is now the global leader in trying, or at least indicting, senior government officials from around the world, but itself hasn't dealt with its own past violations of human rights from the Franco regime. Similarly, states that have joined the International Criminal Court are far more likely to indict and prosecute their leaders for human rights or financial crimes in their domestic courts. Currently, just over half the nations in the world belong to the ICC, but of the countries that have indicted heads of state, 85% are members of the ICC. Half of all heads of state who were indicted were convicted. Now, that might sound like a small number, but many of them died. Some of them were too infirm to be tried. I mean, it's not just that they were indicted and then dropped off the map. There's usually a reason. And actually, there's a chart at the end of the book that actually has an explanation for every single case of what happened at whatever way. But half of those who were indicted were tried and convicted. Half of those served their sentences in prison. Only one was executed, obviously Saddam Hussein. The rest were either sentenced to fines or house arrest, the terms of which varied very widely. Many benefited from policies prevalent in Latin America and Europe, allowing anyone over the age of 70 who was convicted of a crime to serve their sentences at home. And one former head of state, Nicaragua's Arnaldo Alemán, who was convicted of embezzling and laundering $100 million from his impoverished country's public coffers, had his 20-year sentence reduced to 5 years of Nicaraguan arrest, that's in quotes, meaning that what he had to do was to stay in the country, and it was very helpful that he also stumped for his party in the spring 2007 elections. So, you know, as I say, this is not a perfect universe in terms of the consequences being closely aligned with the findings in court. There is no single rationale for why the justice storm has caught on. In some cases, such as Serbia's decision to arrest Slobodan Milosevic for financial crimes and later turn him over to the ICTY, the evidence of external coercive pressure is blatant. In others, the rationale appears to be instrumental but internally driven. Governments in the early phases of a transition to democracy may want to demonstrate their effort to make a fresh start. They may want to lock in international justice norms as a hedge against extremists from either end of the political spectrum who threaten democratic consolidation. Others may want to demonstrate their state's worthiness to join the community of democratic nations or attract foreign aid. But in many countries, the rationale for trials increasingly seems to be normative, and I think that's what's getting to be really interesting. These governments believe that they have a duty to prosecute those most responsible for serious human rights and corruption crimes, even if those individuals once served as heads of state. In other instances, multiple reasons seem to operate simultaneously, with different governmental actors articulating different reasons for their interest in prosecuting. This certainly was the case with respect to Peru's initial interest in bringing Fujimori to trial, though I think I can say, at least in my opinion, by the time Barrios, Altos, and La Cantuta, the time that verdict was handed down, the rationale certainly felt more normative than instrumental. I think that a shift had occurred in Peru as a result of the trial. And I know Caitlin's going to say a bit more about that. Not surprisingly, a government's rationale for trying heads of states is more likely to be normative when none of the current leaders are themselves under threat of being tried. And it'll be interesting if someone may have a question about this, you know, well, what about Peru? And I think that'd be worth exploring some more. Similarly, as in the Fujimori case, the motivation shifts over time, often in multiple directions. So while Chile's interest in prosecuting Pinochet shifted from instrumental to normative, the rationale for Saddam Hussein in Iraq began more as normative and then shifted to a mix of less wholesome reasons as the war escalated. So it's not possible yet to create a simple continuum of rationales for acceptance with coercion on one end and norm embedment on the other. On the other hand, we definitely can see that there is a greater likelihood that the reasons will be normative where the country has undergone a transition that has strengthened democracy and the rule of law. Despite these norms, or excuse me, despite these trends, the justice norm is definitely not fully consolidated. We're able to show that Latin America and Europe are much further along, but then there's isolated cases in other parts of the world, like the case in the book about President Chiluba in Zambia, which is a bit of an anomaly in Africa, but still an exciting development. Just the longstanding tradition that ex-heads of states can find security in exile continues. Obviously, Fujimori himself enjoyed absolute protection of Japan, which even acknowledged him as a citizen until he made the choice to return to Latin America. Mexico is protecting Guatemalan ex-president Alfonso Portilla. France is sheltering Haiti's ex-president Jean-Claude Baby Doc Duvalier. And the U.S. is providing safe haven from extradition to former Bolivian president Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada. And everybody knows former Liberian President Charles Taylor enjoyed the protection of Nigeria for 3 years before it was decided to turn the tables and send him to the special court for Sierra Leone. Nonetheless, indictments and trials are occurring even in the face of some of the countervailing pressures that were often used as justification against pursuing accountability in the past. This is particularly true for countries transitioning to democracy after an extended period of violent conflict or authoritarian or totalitarian rule. Perpetrators there may have been active participants in settlement negotiations or are participating now in democratically elected governments. Trying them may have to compete with other democratic transition priorities such as maintaining order, placating arrest of military or other armed fighters, especially those loyal to a potential defendant, demobilizing and reintegrating ex-combatants or staving off economic collapse. Sometimes, and actually often, the infrastructure and capacity to stage complex high-profile trials is lacking. But even under the worst of circumstances, it seems that lip service is increasingly being paid to the importance of trying those leaders most responsible for serious human rights and financial crimes. Other challenges, which Caitlin will tell you much more about, such as legal or procedural immunities, statutes of limitations, or the principle against retroactive application of the law, have also interfered with trials or restricted the scope of prosecution to a handful of narrowly defined or time-limited charges. In many countries, the public seems to have a high tolerance for what it perceives as the eccentricities of the legal process, provided that ex-leaders who are popularly accused of crimes face judgment for at least some of their misdeeds. At times, the perception of progress may not translate into concrete results. Recognizing that justice must at least be seen to be done, many governments have investigated or indicted former heads of states for crimes committed while in office, only to allow the process to bog down, sometimes for years, in the courts. Others have seen judicial process through to conclusion, but have then pardoned them. That's happened with the Philippines, with Estrada, or quietly arrange for ex-leaders to serve their sentences under very comfortable house arrest or while retaining other publicly provided benefits. To sum up, the momentum to try leaders for their human rights or corruption crimes is spreading around the globe. 47 countries have done so over the past 2 years without experience and any kind of terrorist attacks, coup d'etats, or threats to democracy or the rule of law. And I think that's the exciting piece of news for you, Scott. I mean, we've got the evidence that this doesn't do the harm everybody says it's going to do. In fact, the trials turn out to be like the Nuremberg trial, actually rather boring events. Very exciting things happen in the legal arena, but it puts the public who sit in the audience to sleep. And the newspapers stop covering it except on the big days. And that seems to be another interesting phenomenon as we look around the world at these trials, how ordinary they become. But the trend to having trials is what's exciting. When we're talking 47 countries and almost 69 cases. That's a lot of cases. And I think that, Caitlin and I have written an op-ed to remind the new Obama administration not to put any impediments into the possibility of trying anyone and everyone responsible for the abuses of our own government, and because it's a little too soon. We don't have the evidence ready to go forward, but it would certainly be, in my opinion, a huge mistake to do anything that impedes that process from moving forward in the form of pardons or quashing evidence or in any other way failing to cooperate or even failing to establish the kinds of processes that are necessary to take us to the next level. So with all of that, let me just now turn the microphone over to Caitlin, who will carry us forward looking at the cases in both domestic and international fora. Thank you.
Caitlin.
Thanks, Ellen, and thanks also to OSI for kindly hosting this. And I think one of the most remarkable things about the process of being involved in putting this book together is that we knew it was timely, because the whole point of the book was that since 1990, 69 heads of state or government have been prosecuted in some form. So, I mean, I think that those statistics, when you look at the short time frame within which it has taken place, is remarkable. But even in the course then of trying to put the book together, we were scrambling to keep up with the range of developments. And certainly when we decided to commission a chapter on the story of how Fujimori was brought to justice, the trial at that point hadn't started, then the chapter was revised, and ultimately the book went to press before, obviously, the conviction was handed down 2 weeks ago. The week before, I think, we sent the manuscript off, Karadzic was arrested. I think virtually the same week was when the arrest warrant request was issued by the ICC prosecutor for the President of Sudan. So I think it's any doubt that there is momentum building, I think, is increasingly hard to dispute. Just as a little snapshot of the extent to which this has almost become commonplace in some areas of judicial activity, I think it was in May last year, on a single day, the Special Court for Sierra Leone announced that they had had three former presidents in their courtrooms on the one day. In a courtroom in The Hague, Charles Taylor was in the middle of his trial, and his former deputy prime minister, who had then taken over as president from him for a short-lived 2 months after he turned himself, after he went into exile, was testifying against him, Moses Blah. Back at the Special Court's headquarters in Freetown in Sierra Leone, the former Sierra Leonean president, Ahmed Tejen Kaba, was testifying in defence of one of the rebel leaders in the RUF trial. And, you know, this is one court that ended up with three former heads of state in the midst of their judicial proceedings, with one of whom on trial, and two, certainly one, as a very important insider witness. Half a world away, in that same week, Alberto Fujimori's trial had begun, and he was in the midst of those proceedings. Back at The Hague, there was a small group of staff busily working away in the office of the prosecutor, deciding and discussing and arguing, no doubt, about whether or not there was the evidence to actually ask for an arrest warrant for al-Bashir. On the other side of the world again, in Phnom Penh, Hugh Sampan, the former head of state of the Khmer Rouge's Democratic Kampuchea regime, had landed in his detention cell at the Extraordinary Chambers in the Courts of Cambodia and was preparing an application for pretrial release, being 78 as he was last year. And they're just some of the examples. The book, I think, tries to cover as many as we reasonably could, but there's certainly many more that are continuing to happen. What I want to do briefly, because I do want to not go through too many of the main findings of the book so that you still have some surprise when you get to read it, is just a couple of, I think, the key points that jump out really from the various case studies that we chose. The first of which is the relationship between international and national justice processes. As Juan mentioned, I think that the two things are clearly interlinked. Originally, the international justice movement really developed in response to a lack of progress at the domestic level. And part of the lack of progress was because of legal obstacles and also a lack of political will. The movement that's taken place at the international level has helped facilitate greater movement at the domestic level, but it's an interactive relationship. The second lesson that I'll touch on is, I think, one of the clear messages that these processes aren't easy. I mean, we have documented a huge number of of cases that that have started, and as Alan mentioned, only about half of them have got through to trial phase, and only about half of those again have resulted in a completed trial with leading to a conviction. Not to say that a conviction is the only thing that should be expected at the end of these processes as well. And the last lesson is really, I think, the symbolic power that these types of trials have. And that's why choosing a subset of heads of state, although we stretch it to heads of government for those countries that have a distinction, it really is because of the symbolic power of reaching all the way up the chain of command as high as you can possibly go. So just in terms of, first of all, the relationship between the international and the national, I think the lessons are clearest out of the Latin American experiences, where the movement particularly to launch cases in jurisdictions such as Spain and then Belgium as well, helped fuel responses back home to do it themselves. And I think in the current debates about the focus of the International Criminal Court and resistance that's building to that, I think that's an important thing to remember, that certainly in Latin America, that was the way it played out, that there was greater impetus towards taking things on at a domestic level. The relationship is not also, though, just between countries, between countries actually launching proceedings themselves for a head of state from a third country. The relationship also comes out in extradition proceedings and so on as well. And besides the high-profile example of Pinochet, when General Pinochet certainly did not expect to be ending up dragged through a very long extradition process in the UK, and when he was ultimately allowed to go home, the wrangling that had taken place there had also allowed some political space to develop in Chile for Judge Guzman and others involved in the investigations to take proceedings forward there. One of the other developments that's been happening in the last few weeks is that the former dictator of Chad, Hissène Habré, who has been comfortably in exile in Senegal for many years, is again in the press. And I think this is yet another example of this relationship between different domestic jurisdictions pushing each other. When a group of Chadian victims saw that they weren't going to get very far in Senegal, they launched a case in Belgium. And that case has continued to prompt Senegal to move forward. It's moved a little way forward, but the lack of progress lately has prompted Belgium now to file a case at the International Court of Justice urging Senegal to comply with its obligations under the Torture Convention or to hand over Habré to Belgian courts instead. I think some of the real challenges, though, that go with seeing these cases through are not just legal challenges, whether that's extradition proceedings, actually gaining jurisdiction over individuals. Obviously, the challenges of overturning amnesties that many former leaders give themselves on their way out, or other immunities that may exist at domestic levels. It's also a matter of maintaining the legal process against individuals who most legal processes are not expected or not used to dealing with. And I think this is an important thing to remember if you look at the trials that we look at in the book, which are not just show trials, although some of them are clearly problematic, and the case of Rwanda's case of Bizimungu is certainly one of those examples. But it's not just a matter of giving an accused who's a former head of state a good lawyer and some time to prepare. It's also, I think, addressing the challenge that heads of state literally embody the old regime that they led, and that many people see these trials, therefore, as a chance to put that entire regime, and in some cases the ideology that it represented, on trial. And I think that poses additional difficulties for these trials to maintain their adherence to rule of law standards and due process standards, including things like the presumption of innocence. It's very, very difficult when you're talking about somebody who is at the pinnacle of a regime that has been overturned to preserve that. And I think it's one of the key challenges that faces the courts who deal with them. It's also a challenge to remind the players in the court that they are dealing with an individual, regardless of the fact that they may represent the pinnacle of responsibility. Their task is still to examine the evidence and prove the links between that individual and the policies that they oversaw and how you link that to the specific crimes at the bottom. Evidence of the link, though, often only can come from people inside the regime. And often the heads of state that we've seen who have fallen from power and ended up in court, they may have toppled, but much of the power structure may still remain, particularly within military structures or the security sector. And for individuals within those structures who may still be governed by generals or other leaders who retain loyalty to the old regime, it's a very difficult thing for them to stand in court and testify against their former commander-in-chief. It's particularly difficult when many of these heads of state, including Milosevic, and Charles Taylor was looking like doing it for a while, and there's others as well, when they choose to represent themselves, because then these insider witnesses are being cross-examined by their former leader, and I think the power challenges of dealing with that in the context of a courtroom are significant, to say the least. The other feature that we've seen through many of the cases in the book, and that I think will be familiar to many people because it's the stuff that media love to focus on, is the fact that the ongoing influence of these people can completely disrupt the attempts to conduct a normal legal process. You'll remember, of course, Saddam Hussein and Milosevic adopting similar tactics. Charles Taylor famously declared when he, on the opening day of his trial, when he refused to appear and his lawyer turned up with a letter saying, you know, I refuse to appear as to be a fig leaf for this court's legitimacy. He subsequently toned down his response and decided to cooperate. But it's a very effective tactic that many of these former leaders are able to run with. Refusing to address simple things like refusing to address the judge by normal protocol. Milosevic would famously refer to the presiding judge as Mr. Things like that that these people can get away with in a way that many ordinary accused cannot. And judges are generally not very well equipped at dealing with this. They are used to being in control of their courtroom, not having to play to courts of public opinion, and nor should they. But of course, the accused they are dealing with are highly skilled at this. That's how they've built their careers. They've been surrounded by media-savvy spinmeisters and all the rest of it. And I think that presents fundamental challenges for running these trials. The third lesson, then, is about what the symbolic power of the trials can be if they are done well. I think this gets highlighted partly by the surprise with which several of the accused in the book have manifested when they've actually been brought to justice. I mean, they really do represent people who saw themselves and many people saw them as being certainly above the law. As I said earlier, Pinochet went to London to go to some arms sales and have back surgery. The idea of ending up stuck there for many, many months, caught up in proceedings, was certainly nothing that was anticipated. As Ellen mentioned, when Alberto Fujimori, who was very completely safe in Japan with dual citizenship and so on, completely underestimated the change of political wind and the momentum that was developing, not just in Peru, but in Chile as well. Choosing to voluntarily step into Chile with the hopes of reviving his political fortunes. And I think it makes it all the more impressive from a symbolic perspective when those people have ended up facing proceedings. Reports are from those who were at the Ghanaian peace talks when Charles Taylor had when the arrest warrant and indictment from the special court was revealed. He was on his way to make a statement before the various parties to the peace talks, and apparently he stopped when he heard the news and said, but that's not possible to indict a head of state. and was almost sort of about to keep walking when it sort of sank in, and the Ghanaians produced a presidential jet to take him back home and avoid the embarrassment of the situation. I think the symbolic power, though, exists without necessarily seeing these cases through to the end. And I think that's one of the lessons that the data set and the statistics show, that even though not everybody ends up convicted, and nor should they necessarily be, depending on how the case has been run and prepared, the symbolic power of the fact that General Pinochet died at the age of 91, but having fought for the last 8 years of his life, various attempts, even though he never even faced trial, but that itself was, I think, a huge victory for the victims of his regime who had been fighting for some kind of response. Similarly, Milosevic did die before the end of his trial, only 10 working days before the end of that trial, a trial that had taken many, many months. And one of the reasons it had taken many, many months was that the judges were bending over backwards to allow him the time to prepare a case that he was representing himself for, and which took an enormous toll on his health. The symbolic power, though, lastly, is, I think, also something that is represented through, for many people, in actually seeing these untouchable, formerly untouchable people in the dock. And as I think my favourite quote from one of the case studies from Marika Weirder and Miranda Sisson's chapter on Saddam Hussein is that the power of the trial lay not in ultimately what happened in terms of the execution of Saddam and the political influence that increasingly took over the Iraqi High Tribunal, but it was for many people seeing him have to turn up in court each day, and the way they termed it is the unambiguous extinction of dictatorial dignity. And for me, I think that sums up a lot of the key messages out of the book. But the challenge for these trials is to make sure that extinction of dictatorial dignity doesn't cross over the line into becoming a show trial. And ultimately, if the trials are able to be successful in having a lasting impact on promoting the rule of law, it's through their ordinariness, as Ellen said. It's through their adherence to due process standards, to being transparent, and to actually being relatively uninteresting. The moments of high drama on the first day of the trial, when there's some sort of key witnesses, or the first time the accused takes the stand, and then ultimately when the judgment is announced, are the things that people focus on. But from one of my colleagues who has just been in Lima following Fujimori's trial for the last 15 months, 2 weeks ago, just before the judgment was handed down, he said to me, the most remarkable thing about this of all is that it's been a very long, boring, normal trial. For anybody who sat through a long, normal court process, that was what was significant, that it wasn't a short, fast process that would have exposed itself to much greater challenges on behalf of Fujimori's supporters. That's not to say that all of these cases haven't faced accusations by the supporters of the accused on the basis that they are politically motivated. And yes, of course, there's political motivations in many of them. But the success lies really in being able to show that they are ordinary criminal processes, often tediously boring experiences dominated by incomprehensibly pedantic lawyers. But that's what we do. To finish then, I think really what I'm looking forward to is to listen to Scott and then to have a discussion with all of you about what the implications of the book are, because ultimately I think the message is that the political winds blow in unpredictable ways, and what may have seemed completely impossible at one point has on many occasions suddenly turned into the realm of the possible. So thank you.
Okay, thank you. Scott?
Well, thank you. I want to start by congratulating Cambridge University Press and also Ellen and Caitlin on this book. It's to me, it's amazing to see a work that's so timely, so perfectly directed to our political dialogue in the United States coming out at this moment. I mean, this almost never happens. The only other occasion I can think of, which again was just a virtual coincidence, was when Ahmed Rashid's book on the Taliban wound up being published right around the time of 9/11. Again, you know, almost never happens. But this, just to give a sense of how well triggered this is to the current political discussion and legal discussion in our country, I'll invite you to relive with me a couple of minutes that were broadcast on Fox News last night. And you talked about earlier about media spinmeisters. And I would submit that that there's one person who holds that exalted rank above all others, and his name is Karl Rove. And this is what Mr. Rove had to say with respect to a statement by President Obama that he deemed outlandish. And President Obama's outlandish statement was that the Justice Department would have to deal with the question of criminal culpability coming out of the torture issue. And I would suggest in the first instance, of course, that's outlandish in Karl Rove's mind, because for 8 years he knew that Karl Rove dealt with all questions of criminal liability coming through the Justice Department. Indeed, he's now the subject of a criminal investigation arising out of that, being managed by Nora Dennehy, the U.S. attorney in Connecticut. But this is what he had to say. This is the moral equivalent of Latin American colonels in mirrored sunglasses dispatching their predecessors in power. It's interesting. This is, of course, the senior political advisor of the prior president, the deputy chief of staff. And during the term of this presidency, we saw the introduction of a regime of torture. Indeed, I'll take this opportunity to note that today, John Boehner, the Republican leader in the House, so described it on the floor of the House. We're seeing some breakthrough with use of appropriate language. And in the last week, we've seen a torrent of additional documentation that makes clear how this system was introduced from above. So we saw a series of four memoranda from the Office of Legal Counsel that approved, in fact, specific torture techniques, waterboarding, enclosure, and coffin-like confines, a walling. This is a process of slamming a prisoner's head against a wall. Very, very interesting to see. In fact, General Hayden interviewed about this on Fox, where he interrupted the commentary to say, no. We put a towel around his neck to prevent whiplash. It was humane slamming against the wall. And I won't go through a complete laundry list of the list, but I think these are practices that the U.S., with no hesitation, called torture for decades. Practices that the New York Times, without compunction, described as torture before the advent of the Bush administration. And we also saw the publication now in the last day of the Senate Armed Services Committee report that essentially that was a unanimous committee report signed off on by the ranking member, John McCain, including the endorsement of Lindsey Graham and several other Republican members of the committee. It presents a careful chronology of everything that happened, and it puts through the shredder the defense that the Bush administration put up following the disclosures from Abu Ghraib, the rotten apples defense, for instance, the aggressive suggestion that there was no connection between the torture memoranda, which were disclosed at that time, and what went on in Iraq. And the Senate Armed Services Committee concludes that, no, there's a very direct connection. It tracks it step by step. It notes the existence of previously secret Department of Defense documents in which the Secretary of Defense's instructions for the introduction of these techniques in Iraq and in Afghanistan were carried through. So a direct connection, well documented. It notes, in fact, that in Abu Ghraib we had a group of eight contractors who were linked to the most serious abuses, whose cases were written up. By the way, what happened with those cases? They were referred to the Department of Justice, to the U.S. Attorney in the Eastern District of Virginia. What happened to those cases? Nothing happened to those cases. Makes clear that those contractors were, in fact, CIA contractors, bringing a link back to those OLC memoranda. And yesterday evening, almost unremarked upon media, though, there was a memorandum released by Eric Holder summarizing some of the conclusions from CIA documents about the course of dealings between the CIA and the White House in the approval process, setting out the process of approval and identifying by office the individuals who were involved in the approval process. You'll see a piece by John Sifton that's just been put up at the Daily Beast, in which you'll see, instead of the offices, you'll see the actual names of the people, because they richly deserve to be named. And you'll see that that process included formal sign-off for torture by Condoleezza Rice, with the approval of her lawyer, John Bellinger, and that all occurring with the consent and knowledge of Vice President Cheney and George Bush. So, again, in the course of the last couple of days, it seems we've come close to closing the circle. We know where this process started in the White House, and we know where the approvals wound up in the White House, and it very clearly goes to the top of the government. So I would submit maybe we are talking about a handful of rotten apples, but they're at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, no doubt about that. So I think it's quite remarkable, given these disclosures, really in the last few press cycles, that we now see the ultimate spinmeister saying that, well, if you demand accountability, you're behaving like a Latin American colonel with mirrored sunglasses after the last coup dealing with your predecessor. He's suggesting that, in fact, accountability would demonstrate political immaturity, political instability, that it would show, it would mark a decline of our democratic institutions. It would be the opening volley of political warfare. That's the suggestion. Why do we see this argument? Well, first of all, I want to note that I track this using Google and LexisNexis, and I noted it was amazing. 6 hours after Karl Rove made this statement on Fox, Arlen Specter went to the well of the Senate and gave a speech in which, almost word for word, he made the same charges. He didn't talk about the mirrored sunglasses. I think that was about the only phrase he dropped from the entire thing. And we saw in the Wall Street Journal this morning, again, the same argument. The Weekly Standard also running a piece with the same argument. This is now developing as the core of the defense that's being put together by the alumni of the Bush administration with respect to demands for accountability. Why? I think they've concluded that it's the most effective defense that's available to them. That is to say, this is all just politics. The charges that are being brought against us are by our political adversaries being advanced for political purposes. That is to state as strongly as possible that justice is playing no role here. This is, as best I can count, at least the third line of defense that's been thrown up, because the prior defenses have been abandoned. Remember, the first defense was the rotten apples defense, which was agreed upon, coordinated, and put out very aggressively in the 1 month after the Abu Ghraib disclosures. And then after that, we heard the repetitions, America does not torture, we do not torture, over and over again, a mantra from President Bush, a mantra that I think has been totally shattered right now. Has been, and we've seen Vice President Cheney very aggressive. We got valuable intelligence, actionable intelligence, and thousands of American lives were saved as a result. So these are, you know, the accountability process, and I think they are coming with increasing alacrity, and I think a slowly rising recognition that demands for accountability are serious. And moreover, I think Karl Rove and many others, Vice President Cheney, I think for a while they were misled by the inside, really have some prosecution of prior political leaders in this country, because it would destabilize, it would poison the environment, it wouldn't be able to function. I think there was a sense that demands for accountability. In fact, I had a meeting with a senior Democratic figure on the Judiciary Committee, Senate Judiciary Committee, who told me last fall that really the only people who were demanding accountability in some form or a truth commission were just extreme leftists, as if the torture issue were, of course, a left-right issue. I think 2 weeks later, I was very pleased to send him a copy of the ABC Washington Post poll showing that clique of extreme leftists amounted to 74% of the American population. So really, I think with the public generally, there is a very strong sense, much stronger than in Washington, that this issue can't just be dropped. It has to be brought to some logical conclusion, and a demand particularly that all the facts have to come out. They have to be fully developed. The public needs to know what's happened, and really only on the basis of this full development of the facts should decisions be taken about pardons, amnesties, and prosecutions. So I think we're right now in a difficult situation for Washington in particular, a difficult situation for the White House and the Justice Department. I think the White House engaged in, you know, some of its most ham-handed conduct since Barack Obama was sworn in on exactly this issue just in the course of the last week. In fact, if we go back, we'll see Barack Obama clearly involved in this decision to publish the OLC memoranda, and I think making an absolutely correct decision to go ahead and release them, and deciding politically to balance this by giving people in the CIA some assurance that they didn't really need to worry about prosecutions. So he is Langley, where we see these intimidated CIA workers giving him a boisterous reception. I don't know if you all saw this, but I watched it and I thought, like, I think someone's misdescribing the morale at the agency to him. He gave them the same assurance in terms of criminal investigation and prosecution in his remarks at Langley. And I think that was really pressing the outer edges of propriety for a president of the United States to be given some sort of advance assurance about who would and who wouldn't be prosecuted. But if that was pressing the outer edge, then certainly in the next day of the press cycle, that boundary was clearly exceeded by Rahm Emanuel, who on this week with George Stephanopoulos proceeded to say, and by the way, we're not going to go after the memo writers or the decision makers either. There isn't going to be any accountability. A few hours later, we saw the presidential press secretary confirming that this was the official policy of the White House. So look at this dilemma. You know, we have a president elected who has recognized the mess that was created in the last administration through the politicization of the Justice Department, who in fact campaigned on it. And here in the first 100 days of his office, he is proceeding as if he were giving from the White House direct instructions to professional prosecutors as to how they were to handle their cases, violating these rules in a much more flagrant way, a much more public way than ever occurred in the Bush administration. I think it was a sickening thing to see. And it's complicating how this matter goes forward, I think, because now if the Attorney General, if Eric Holder decides, well, I'm not going to appoint a prosecutor, to all the world it will appear that he is implementing the political decision of President Obama. And at that point, my friends, how are we to distinguish Eric Holder in the role of Attorney General from Alberto Gonzalez in the role of Attorney General? And all this in the against the background of the question of torture, which John McCain correctly described as the defining moral issue of our day. For our country, depressing. Well, going back to this book, I think it offers first of all a direct response to Karl Rove and his example. It tells him, as usual, you're living in an alternate universe. In fact, in Latin America, the day of rule by colonels wearing mirrored sunglasses has passed. And one of the things that's brought it to a conclusion is a process of accountability. That in fact, heads of state who torture, who authorize programs whereby people are disappeared, wind up being the targets of criminal investigation, being prosecuted, and in the case of Alberto Fujimori, being sentenced to 25 years in prison. To me, it was amazing reading the account of the Fujimori case when I started going through the list of charges against former President Fujimori. I would say, no, there wasn't a one-for-one coincidence with Bush, but there were really a remarkable number of charges that I thought, yes, it's the same charge that could be brought, and now we see substantial documentation for it. So I think this work, the example of Latin America, but not only Latin America, shows that, no, Karl Rove has it exactly backwards, that a mature democratic state that's confident of itself doesn't hesitate to hold a former political leader to account for violations of the law. But there's some other points in here I think that are very, very interesting. I mean, one, it seems to me, is time, the passage of time. In our discussion in the United States now, we hear a lot of people saying, well, there has to be action right now. We have to charge ahead. We need a prosecutor appointed today. We need to get going on this while the public is focused on it. And the experience I see collected here tells me just the opposite. It's much better to let time run. That the appearance of retribution, of political motivation, is very strong at the time of transfer of power. And it is, in fact, disruptive of a democracy to proceed immediately with criminal charges against a democratic leader who's just left office. But this is a problem that can be cured not by forgetting it and letting bygones be bygones, but allowing time to take its course and instead meticulously, carefully, and slowly developing all of the facts. And I think this really, it explains the case. I think it's true for Chile, for Argentina, and for Peru, for all these three cases. The passage of time allows the accountability process to flow more smoothly, and it allows those who are pursuing it to overcome this objection that this is an act of political retribution. But another point that seems to me is a distinction and is a bit troubling. Is who were the victims? Because here in most of these cases, no, in all these cases, the victims are nationals of the country involved. And that really provides a lot of the momentum. I mean, the Peruvian case, it's particularly clear how that works out, you know, and the countryside, the affected areas in the south, you know, where there is this great resentment that helps fuel the process over a period of years. And the same with communities in Argentina and Chile. When we're talking about the United States, we don't have many American citizens who were victimized by torture and the torture regime. I think actually there's more than people are focusing on right now because, of course, actually we had Captain Yi and we had Jose Padilla. So we had two people, American citizens, who were put through many of these techniques, isolation and other things. But we also had American soldiers and intelligence officers who were asked to be torturers. And in my view, they were victims here. And that hasn't been given, I think, quite the level of play that it deserves. But nevertheless, I think this is a distinction between the experiences that are recounted here and the American experience that it seems to me will make it more difficult to build the national consensus that's necessary to pursue these things. And Ellen, I want to note, you know, in your remarks you talked about how important it was from this study not to allow the prosecution to get ahead of the public and the public's understanding of the process. That strikes me as a really important point, a significant point. That is that you've got to build a public understanding for what's going on and a public acceptance for it. Again, that's how you get over, it seems to me, this question of retribution and political motivation. Certainly President Obama is telling us all we need to look forward, not look to the past. I agree with that analysis, but I understand it quite differently from him. I look forward to the future, and I'm concerned about torture. And I'm concerned about whether it's really been terminated. And right now, it's ended on the strength of a series of executive orders that Barack Obama has issued. And it can just as easily be reinstated through a set of executive orders issued by another president in the future. There's nothing that stands in the way of that, as best I can see. And I haven't heard any really persuasive argument to the contrary from President Obama or his White House. And that means Dick Cheney, Karl Rove, Michael Mukasey, and Michael Hayden, because they are all, in fact, arguing that we go back to that. So it seems to me that this problem is still with us. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I have a lot of questions, but in the interest of giving those in the audience an opportunity to pose questions, I'm going to forego my own questions. I would ask you again, if you have questions, to go to the microphone and to make the questions or any comments brief. Yes.
Human Rights First. Thanks for your presentations. Caitlin, I wanted to ask you about the uncertain political winds that you talked about, and I think you all touched on this, but what are the key lessons that your research reveals in terms of the national conditions that you need in order to make it more likely that heads of state are going to be prosecuted? So when you look at countries where it has happened and where it hasn't happened, I'm thinking of places like Guatemala, what are some of the key lessons you think that we can take away?
I think there's a few things that the cases in the book highlight, and we actually try to summarise this a little bit in the book in terms of what makes a successful kind of confluence of circumstances. Whether or not that's actually what causes the winds to change is a slightly different point, and I think that, although they do relate. I mean, first, you do need to have a government that wants to differentiate itself from the past. And one of the reasons and one of the factors in whether or not that's the case is partly whether or not there's people within the new regime who may be implicated, or the connections between the new and the old. And so I think that's one of the key factors. One of the other things that certainly from the group of cases we looked at, it also, I think, a big factor was how well the principles and adherence to the rule of law is embedded as well. Although we have seen some progress in some cases who have certainly far more fragile democracies and judiciaries, most importantly, than certainly here in the US. But that strength of the judiciary, I think, is another really key thing, and that's obviously one of the challenges with somewhere like Guatemala. The political discussions are always going to be there, and the allegations of politicisation and the risk of politicisation is always going to be there. But what ultimately, I think, gets these things over the line is whether or not the judiciary is able to be independent enough to inspire and transparent enough in the process to inspire a broad enough base of public trust in the process, because otherwise it is too easy to dismiss these attempts and to have them caught up in political circumstances. So, I mean, I guess the thing that underpins all of that is the extent of public demand for accountability as well. And the two things are linked, because if people don't have any trust in their justice system being able to respond to these things, they're less likely to expect it to be a source of redress as well. So I think that's one of the difficulties, is trying to get over some of those hurdles. But as to ultimately when the political winds change, it's partly through seeing that this is possible. Certainly in the examples of the influence from one country to another that we've seen, and the range of precedents that we now have itself, I think, has led to some more winds change.
There's only one more I might add to that, which is the amount of, you know, there has to be political space to do it. I mean, I think, you know, one in an economic situation like the United States, you know, at this very moment, on top of everything else, I think there, you know, the space is not there yet, and that because people's priorities are elsewhere. So I think that's an important list.
I want to call on Ted Sorensen.
I'd like to ask a hypothetical legal question to such a distinguished group that's given such a stirring and important presentation. Hypothetically, is there any jurisdiction in the world, including any town or county or village in the United States, where a public official who either authorizes or directs his subordinate to grab a dog by the collar and crash that dog's head against the wall would not be prosecuted?
I think the question answers itself. Thank you.
Chicago.
Other questions? Again, if you'd go to the microphone, and if anybody else wants to ask a further question, if you'd line up behind, I think that would be the most efficient way to proceed.
Sorry, James Cocaine from J
James Kikane from the International Peace Institute, just continuing the Australian theme.
A little closer to the mic.
Sorry. James Kikane, International Peace Institute. I was wondering, in how many of these cases the prosecution was brought, the indictment was brought, while the country was still said to be in a state of war, and how that discourse of war, and whether it's still there or whether it's nominally been ended, affects the political dynamics or reflects them, and what its relevance might be, Scott, for the current situation here in this country.
I think we'd have to go through our chart, but I think from off the top of my head, Iraq, obviously, is probably the most direct domestic example. Most of the other cases where there has been some kind of ongoing conflict context has been one of the reasons why it's international justice mechanisms that have stepped in. And certainly, Charles Taylor, when he was indicted, there was still active conflict in Liberia, certainly when Milosevic was indicted. I think it's probably more of the internationals, although the international cases are only, I think, four or five of the ones in the book. But the vast majority of the domestic ones have required some level of transition to have taken place, although not always a huge time delay. There's often been a time delay, but not necessarily always. It's depended.
I would just suggest you should take a look at the ICJ report on counterterrorism that was just issued by an eminent jurist panel that was chaired, I think, by Arthur Chaskelson, included Mary Robinson, Bob Goldman, a number of others, because in the Latin America section of it, they focus on exactly this issue, which is how a determination that a state of war existed became a political point that was struggled over, and that in fact it had an awful lot to do with
Saddam Hussein or something else. And so I wondered how you thought trying to prosecute a sitting head of state differed or reinforced some of the conclusions you had in your book. And likewise, Scott, your point about letting time pass, it seems like prosecuting a sitting head of state, there's a very different dynamic in terms of how much time can go past and what kind of facts can be gathered. And I wanted to know what both of you thought about the Bashir case in those facts.
Before they answer the question, I just want to thank Adam Day, who back in his student days as actually one of the research assistants on this book project.
Thanks, Adam. certainly... the sitting heads of state, I mean, there's Taylor, Milosevic were also indicted while they were sitting heads of state. So, and I think one of the lessons that we've seen out of those cases has been the stigmatising or delegitimising effect of those individuals, and that the same arguments were put forward beforehand or at the time when, certainly in Taylor's case, at the time the indictment and arrest warrant were unsealed, people said this is going to derail the peace talks in Liberia. Perhaps the peace talks were a little more advanced in that case than the situation in Sudan. But I also think it is partly a matter of time. And while obviously President Bashir's flying around visiting friendly countries is you know, a deliberately provocative move, I think it's too soon to assess what the long-term effects of the arrest warrant in relation to what we've seen in the past is going to be. But certainly, I think that has been a clear lesson about the impact.
The only other thing I would say is that we all remember Milosevic attending the Dayton Peace Accords and obviously didn't anticipate, you know, things to come. And I always, you know, he was not indicted by at that point, obviously, but still it's, or was there a...
There is an argument still about that.
There is some...
Well, Karadzic is raising that argument right now before the Yugoslav Tribunal, that he was given assurances of being immune from prosecution because the indictment against him had already been issued at the time he was... involved in talks with Holbrooke and others. So,
but one of the things we often say, and as we think about these cases, is, and we argue about what language to use in saying it. But you know, are amnesties dead? And I certainly wouldn't I don't think they hold water anymore because, the Charles Taylor case is sort of, the quintessential example of one where, the world basically promised him he was safe, and he was not safe. And he was, when the tide turned, Milosevic, Charles Taylor found themselves in the dock. And I think that you can't anticipate that you won't be indicted any longer for these crimes, even if a whole host of other governments or your own government senior officials tell you that you're safe.
No, in fact, there's an important point on this that relates to universal jurisdiction because it seems if people promise amnesty, one thing they're doing is they're undertaking that they're not going to prosecute. Under principles of universal jurisdiction, that may very well open the door for other countries to step in and prosecute. And I think that comes back to the conclusion you just stated, which I endorse too. I just don't see how you have an effective amnesty in the current regime. I mean, the possibility might be through the Security Council in some very formal sense, but certainly not, chatter that goes on in the backdrop of some sort of negotiation. No, it would require a high level of formality for it to be effective.
Thank you. My name is Carla Dejas. I'm from NYU's Center for Global Affairs. I have two questions, actually. One is, how do you feel the debate over peace versus justice fits into the discussion of prosecuting heads of state, particularly sitting heads of state? And my second question is for Mr. Horton, whether you could discuss a bit about Senator Leahy's proposition for a TRC to investigate the abuses of the Bush administration.
Well, let's say Senator Leahy's proposal, I'd be delighted to discuss it when he writes it, because he hasn't. He's given a series of press conferences about it. I've talked to him and his staff about it. And in the press conferences, you've seen a pretty dramatic evolution of the idea. So he started out saying it should all be about an amnesty with the presumption that there's some sort of amnesty. Then after a hearing, he came to understand that that was a bad idea. In fact, I think that Justice Chaskelson had some role in explaining to him that he was totally misunderstanding what had happened in South Africa. So I think he's moved more towards the proposal that Congressman Conyers has put forward, which I like. I mean, it strikes me as a suitable basis for a commission, and it's one that outfits the commissioners with all sorts of tools to pursue things, but gives them a lot of discretion. It also has another very wise aspect, which is that it modifies the statute of limitations. Saying that there really should be no pressure to get to the end of this and decide to prosecute or not prosecute. Let's just remove that pressure. Let's suspend entirely the statute of limitations with respect to these crimes. So I think Conyers is on track. My sense right now is that there's more public pressure for this commission approach than Congress is prepared to deal with. There was a broad-based demand from a number of major NGOs in support of it. I think that went out yesterday, the day before yesterday, and polling shows very broad public support for it. And the problem is essentially, 40 Republican senators who don't want it.
Right. And let me interject on the peace versus justice question. I don't really think it's possible to predict whether invoking justice is going to contribute to peace or make peace more difficult. There have been several cases in the history of the international tribunals when there were claims that indictments would prevent peace. It happened when Karadzic and Mladic were indicted for the second time just before the Dayton peace talks, and some of those who were organizing the Dayton peace talks were very angry because they thought it would be impossible as a result of that to negotiate a peace settlement. What actually happened is that Karadzic and Mladic had to stay away, and in their absence, it actually proved easier for the three presidents
of Serbia, Croatia, and Bosnia to negotiate a peace agreement. The issue came up in connection with the indictment of Milosevic. Milosevic was indicted while the war in Kosovo was underway, and one of the two international mediators at the time was Viktor Chernomyrdin, the former Russian prime minister. He said it would make it impossible to resolve the war in Kosovo. 1 week later, Milosevic capitulated, and the war in Kosovo ended. The same thing happened in 2003 when the indictment of Charles Taylor was made public by the Special Court for Sierra Leone. It was argued that it would be impossible to resolve the war that was then underway in Liberia. After it was made public, 3 months later, Taylor fled to Nigeria, and the war came to an end. At least in the experience in international justice, it hasn't worked that way. It could work the other way. I don't think we can know which way it would work, and my own view is that peace and justice are both important. They are independent values, but I don't think one can deal with justice simply as a way of trying to promote a peace. In fact, it sometimes works exactly the opposite way. Ahead. And then I think the people who are lined up now will be the final questioners.
My name is Liz Jordan. I'm also from Human Rights First. I wanted to ask Caitlin about the interactive relationship you pointed out between domestic justice initiatives and the international mechanisms. And I agree. I think, you know, Spain with universal jurisdiction has been really effective in Latin America, but on the flip side is under enormous pressure right now. And then also the Inter-American Court was really effective in moving the Peru case forward. And then finally, UN tribunals have gone through a bit of an evolution. So what do you think the role for international justice mechanisms should be going forward, and sort of what form do you think international justice mechanisms should take? Thanks.
Well, I think, I mean, what we have now is a permanent international criminal court, and we also still have some hybrid tribunals that have been able to, that I think we may well see new versions of, primarily in circumstances where there is either lack of capacity or lack of political will. And so I think that complementary relationship, for an obvious term, I think, does have more life left in it, and actually far more fleshing out of that needs to be done. And I mean, I think looking at the relationship, for example, between the Bosnian War Crimes Chamber and the ICTY is something that is a very interesting example to look forward towards, because, I mean, when ICTY was created, it was partly because it was impossible at the time, not just because of an ongoing conflict, but because of the political situation more broadly and the divisions within the various countries to proceed. But work actually that OSJI has done in the last year has looked in more detail at how having the ICTY there actually allowed the political space and time to develop within Bosnia, certainly, to then be able to set up its own process, still with some international assistance. And again, that's why I think that sort of relationship is not just about international courts versus national courts, but it plays out in a whole range of different ways. So,
Pamela Yates.
Hi, Pamela Yates, yeah, from Skylight Pictures. We've been talking tonight about the symbolic value, and I believe in the symbolic value of investigations and indictments and trials. But I worry sometimes, for example, in the Guatemala case, I wonder if the panel could speak to this, where there's been frustration and stalling. Indictments, investigations have happened, indictments have come down, but the people indicted are not being extradited to Spain, and two of the eight have died. So I'm just wondering if you know, you could speak to about that frustration. I wonder if sometimes we're not rationalizing that these things have value when actually people are seeing that the people indicted are still enjoying impunity. Thanks.
I don't think the answer is completely, you know, the unwillingness in the current Guatemala is real incapacity, and on top of political confusion. I mean, you know, we're now having a country that's turning over presidents and turning over legislatures, and obviously there's a case that's been brought in a foreign country, but the ideal would be to do the case in Guatemala. I mean, certainly the lawyers working on the Spain case are really interested in seeing a Guatemala case that's a proper Guatemalan case, but you don't have a capable judiciary yet. You don't have a capable set of domestic laws and frameworks for actually doing that. I don't know whether Guatemala, I can't remember if Guatemala's ratified the ICC, but I'm sure they don't yet have in place the, you know, any kind of domestic, domestic legal, both laws and processes that could then be used by courts, those, and then the judges themselves wouldn't be well trained to use those mechanisms. We haven't created an international system that takes the very sophisticated learning from the ad hoc tribunals and other tribunals, as well as the ICC now, and transferred that back into the domestic jurisdiction, so that countries that finally might have the willingness to allow such things to go forward have the capability of doing so. And I find that more the problem with Guatemala than I do the unwillingness of, say, 5, 7, 10 years ago.
If you don't mind adding to that, I think the problem is not having the political will so much as having the political will to let justice run its course. And I think that's what's lacking in Guatemala. I mean, it's not a lack of institutional capabilities. In the last few years, Guatemala has attempted to reform its judiciary, but the de facto impunity that exists in many Latin American countries still today, which is a variety of methods by which any effort by the judiciary is thwarted by pressures, by interference, by not letting justice run its course, is still unfortunately very much present in Guatemala. But I think it's appropriate to mention some of the attempts in Guatemala, because they are attempts, and they are good faith attempts. They are frustrating, of course, but they are good faith attempts. And I think that's what distinguishes, maybe in answer to an earlier question about what makes it happen, the one ingredient that doesn't make it happen in Guatemala is this political will, not so much to force prosecutions, but to let justice run its course.
Okay, and final question.
Okay. Sorry, my name's Kirsten Hagen, and I'm here in my personal capacity. Ellen, you mentioned that certain communities, victim communities, were relatively tolerant of the vagaries of justice, and that they seemed satisfied that at least some of the charges were brought against the former heads of state. My question is whether you actually looked at the views of victim communities and also of the community at large about the prosecutions, excuse me, of the head of state of their country, and how they felt about those, whether they were satisfied, and if they were or weren't, what were the different factors that led to greater or lesser satisfaction? Thanks.
Well, we certainly looked at it. That was one of the criteria for the case study. So I hope that you'll read them, because some of them have lovely analyses of just how the public, all of them have some analysis of it. But some of the cases, I'm thinking of the Chalupa case, the Estrada case. What are some of the others that? Oh, the brilliant Iraq case. I mean, that the case study there, where they were not just sitting in the courtroom. They were very much out in the community and trying to gauge public reaction, and they marry that in their discussion to the what's going on in the courtroom and how things shift in time. So that this is not, I mean, we had a lot of trouble when we were trying to decide, you know, which division of Cambridge University Press to send the book to, because is this a political science book or is it a law book? And it ended up in the law department, but there's an awful lot of rich material in the actual case chapters that really, you know, delves deeply into that issue.
Okay. Thank you very much. It's 8 o'clock, so I want to bring this to a close. Thank you, Alan Lutz. Thank you, Caitlin Rieger, Scott Horton, and Juan Mendez. And again, if you haven't yet purchased the book, and if they're still for sale, I hope you will acquire a copy. Thank you all for attending.
I'm glad you were.
Did we sell some books for you? I hope.
I hope so. Thank you,
Scott. Thank you. Is that woman who wrote the brilliant case study on Iraq?
I know. Where is she? Exactly.
Have you met people?
We actually met through a completely separate
channel. Oh, I'm so glad that you ended up where you ended up, and that just, you know, that was.
Yeah.
Who?
Oh,
lovely to meet you. What a great traveler. Yeah, but I'm pleased that you're here at least.
Next week,
well, she did. There was such a, you know, so exciting to come. I think it really laid
Yeah,
the culmination is brilliant.
I have totally left my car frontline as well. Yeah, do that. I've got Wendy's email, I think.
Saddam Hussein or something else. And so I wondered how you thought trying to prosecute a sitting head of state differed or reinforced some of the conclusions you had in your book. And likewise, Scott, your point about letting time pass, it seems like prosecuting a sitting head of state, there's a very different dynamic in terms of how much time can go past and what kind of facts can be gathered. And I wanted to know what both of you thought about the Bashir case in those facts.
Before they answer the question, I just want to thank Adam Day, who back in his student days as actually one of the research assistants on this book project.
Thanks, Adam. I mean, certainly the sitting heads of state, I mean, there's Taylor, Milosevic were also indicted while they were sitting heads of state. So. And I think one of the lessons that we've seen out of those cases has been the stigmatising or delegitimising effect of those individuals, and that the same arguments were put forward beforehand or at the time when, certainly in Taylor's case, at the time the indictment and arrest warrant were unsealed, people said this is going to derail the peace talks in Liberia. Perhaps the peace talks were a little more advanced in that case than the situation in Sudan. But I also think it is partly a matter of time. And while obviously President Bashir's flying around visiting friendly countries is you know, a deliberately provocative move, I think it's too soon to assess what the long-term effects of the arrest warrant in relation to what we've seen in the past is going to be. But certainly I think that has been a clear lesson about the impact.
The only other thing I would say is that we all remember Milosevic attending the Dayton Peace Accords and obviously didn't anticipate, you know, things to come. And I always, you know, he was not indicted at that point, obviously, but still it's, or was there a...
There is an argument still about that.
There is some...
Well, Karadzic is raising that argument right now before the Yugoslav Tribunal, that he was given assurances of being immune from prosecution because the indictment against him had already been issued at the time he was... involved in talks with Holbrooke and others. So,
but one of the things we often say, and as we think about these cases, is, and we argue about what language to use in saying it, but you know, are amnesties dead? And I certainly wouldn't. I don't think they hold water anymore because, I mean, the Charles Taylor case is sort of the quintessential example of one where you know the world basically promised him he was safe, and he was not safe, and he was, you know, when the tide turned. Milosevic, Charles Taylor found themselves in the dock, and I think that you can't anticipate that you won't be indicted any longer for these crimes, even if a whole host of other governments or your own government senior officials tell you that you're safe.
No, in fact, there's an important point on this that relates to universal jurisdiction, because it seems if people promise amnesty, one thing they're doing is they're undertaking that they're not going to prosecute. Under principles of universal jurisdiction, that may very well open the door for other countries to step in and prosecute. And I think that comes back to the conclusion you just stated, which I endorse too. I just don't see how you have an effective amnesty in the current regime. I mean, the possibility might be through the Security Council in some very formal sense, but certainly not, you know, chatter that goes on in the backdrop of some sort of negotiation. No, it would require a high level of formality for it to be effective.
Thank you. My name is Carla De Caz. I'm from NYU's Center for Global Affairs. I have two questions, actually. One is, how do you feel the debate over peace versus justice fits into the discussion of prosecuting heads of state, particularly sitting heads of state? And my second question is for Mr. Horton, whether you could discuss a bit about Senator Leahy's proposition for a TRC to investigate the abuses of the Bush administration.
Well, let's say Senator Leahy's proposal, I'd be delighted to discuss it when he writes it. Because he hasn't. He's given a series of press conferences about it. I've talked to him and his staff about it. And in the press conferences, you've seen a pretty dramatic evolution of the idea. So he started out saying it should all be about an amnesty with the presumption that there's some sort of amnesty. Then after a hearing, he, I think, came to understand that that was a bad idea. In fact, I think that Justice Chaskelson had some role in explaining to him that he was totally misunderstanding what had happened in South Africa. So I think he's moved more towards the proposal that Congressman Conyers has put forward, which I like. I mean, it strikes me as a suitable basis for a commission, and it's one that outfits the commissioners with all sorts of tools to pursue things, but gives them a lot of discretion. It also has another very wise aspect, which is that it modifies the statute of limitations. Saying that, you know, there really should be no pressure to get to the end of this and decide to prosecute or not prosecute. Let's just remove that pressure. Let's suspend entirely the statute of limitations with respect to these crimes. So I think Conyers is on track. My sense right now is that there's more public pressure for this commission approach than Congress is prepared to deal with. There was a broad-based demand from a number of major NGOs in support of it. I think that went out yesterday, the day before yesterday, and polling shows very broad public support for it. And the problem is essentially, 40 Republican senators. Who don't want it.
Right. And let me interject on the peace versus justice question. I don't really think it's possible to predict whether invoking justice is going to contribute to peace or make peace more difficult. There have been several cases in the history of the international tribunals when there were claims that indictments would prevent peace. It happened when Karadzic and Mladic were indicted for the second time just before the Dayton peace talks, and some of those who were organizing the Dayton peace talks were very angry because they thought it would be impossible as a result of that to negotiate a peace settlement. What actually happened is that Karadzic and Mladic had to stay away, and in their absence, it actually proved easier for the three presidents of Serbia, Croatia, and Bosnia to negotiate a peace agreement. The issue came up in connection with the indictment of Milosevic. Milosevic was indicted while the war in Kosovo was underway, and one of the two international mediators at the time was Viktor Chernomyrdin, the former Russian prime minister. He said it would make it impossible to resolve the war in Kosovo. 1 week later, Milosevic capitulated, and the war in Kosovo ended. The same thing happened in 2003. When the indictment of Charles Taylor was made public by the Special Court for Sierra Leone, It was argued that it would be impossible to resolve the war that was then underway in Liberia. And after it was made public, 3 months later, Taylor fled to Nigeria, and the war came to an end. So at least in the experience in international justice, it hasn't worked that way. It could work the other way. I don't think we can know which way it would work, and my own view is that peace and justice are both important. They are independent values, but I don't think one can deal with justice simply as a way of trying to promote a peace. In fact, it sometimes works exactly the opposite way. Ahead. And then I think the people who are lined up now will be the final questioners.
My name is Liz Jordan. I'm also from Human Rights First. I wanted to ask Caitlin about the interactive relationship you pointed out between domestic justice initiatives and the international mechanisms. And I agree. I think, you know, Spain with universal jurisdiction has been really effective in Latin America, but on the flip side, it's under enormous pressure right now. And then also the Inter-American Court was really effective in moving the Peru case forward. And then finally, UN tribunals have gone through a bit of an evolution. So what do you think the role for international justice mechanisms should be going forward, and sort of what form do you think international justice mechanisms should take? Thanks.
Well, I think, I mean, what we have now is a permanent international criminal court, and we also still have some hybrid tribunals that have been able to, that I think we may well see new versions of, primarily in circumstances where there is either lack of capacity or lack of political will. And so I think that complementary relationship, for an obvious term, I think, does have more life left in it, and actually far more fleshing out of that needs to be done. And I mean, I think looking at the relationship, for example, between the Bosnian War Crimes Chamber and the ICTY is something that is a very interesting example to look forward towards, because, I mean, when ICTY was created, it was partly because it was impossible at the time, not just because of an ongoing conflict, but because of the political situation more broadly and the divisions within within the various countries to proceed. But work actually that OSJI has done in the last year has looked in more detail at how having the ICTY there actually allowed the political space and time to develop within Bosnia, certainly, to then be able to set up its own process, with some international assistance. And again, that's why I think that sort of relationship is not just about international courts versus national courts, but it plays out in a whole range of different ways. So,
Pamela Yates.
Hi, Pamela Yates, yeah, from Skylight Pictures. We've been talking tonight about the symbolic value, and I believe in the symbolic value of investigations and indictments and trials. But I worry sometimes, for example, in the Guatemala case, I wonder if the panel could speak to this, where there's been frustration and stalling. Indictments, investigations have happened, indictments have come down, but the people indicted are not being extradited to Spain, and two of the eight have died. So I'm just wondering if, you know, you could speak to about that frustration. I wonder if sometimes we're not rationalizing that these things have value when actually people are seeing that the people indicted are still enjoying impunity. Thanks.
I don't think the answer is completely, you know, the unwillingness in the current Guatemala is real incapacity on top of political confusion. I mean, we're now having a country that's turning over presidents and turning over legislatures, and obviously there's a case that's been brought in a foreign country, but the ideal would be to do the case in Guatemala. I mean, certainly the lawyers working on the Spain case are really interested in seeing a Guatemala case that's a proper Guatemalan case, but you don't have a capable judiciary yet. You don't have a capable set of domestic laws and frameworks for actually doing that. I don't know whether Guatemala, I can't remember if Guatemala has ratified the ICC, but I'm sure they don't yet have in place
the, you know, any kind of domestic, domestic legal, both laws and processes that could then be used by courts, those, and then the judges themselves wouldn't be well trained to use those mechanisms. We haven't created an international system that takes the very sophisticated learning from the ad hoc tribunals and other tribunals, as well as the ICC now, and transferred that back into the domestic jurisdiction, so that countries that finally might have the willingness to allow such things to go forward have the capability of doing so. And I find that more the problem with Guatemala than I do the unwillingness of, say, 5, 7, 10 years ago.
If you don't mind my adding to that, I think the problem is not having the political will so much as having the political will to let justice run its course. And I think that's what's lacking in Guatemala. I mean, it's not a lack of institutional capabilities. In the last few years, Guatemala has attempted to reform its judiciary, but the de facto impunity that exists in many Latin American countries still today, which is a variety of methods by which any effort by the judiciary is thwarted by pressures, by interference, by not letting justice run its course, is still unfortunately very much present in Guatemala. But I think it's appropriate to mention some of the attempts in Guatemala, because they are attempts, and they are good faith attempts. They are frustrating, of course, but they are good faith attempts. And I think that's what distinguishes, maybe in answer to an earlier question about what makes it happen, the one ingredient that doesn't make it happen in Guatemala is this political will, not so much to force prosecutions, but to let justice run its course.
Okay, and final question.
Okay. Sorry, my name's Kirsten Hagen, and I'm here in my personal capacity. Ellen, you mentioned that certain communities, victim communities, were relatively tolerant of the vagaries of justice, and that they seemed satisfied that at least some of the charges were brought against the former heads of state. My question is whether you actually looked at the views of victim communities and also of the community at large about the prosecutions, excuse me, of the head of state of their country, and how they felt about those, whether they were satisfied, and if they were or weren't, what were the different factors that led to greater or lesser satisfaction? Thanks.
Well, we certainly looked at it. That was one of the criteria for the case study. So I hope that you'll read them, because some of them have lovely analyses of just how the public, all of them have some analysis of it, but some of the cases, I'm thinking of the Chalupa case, the Estrada case. What are some of the others that, the brilliant Iraq case. I mean, that the case study there, where they were not just sitting in the courtroom. They were very much out in the community and trying to gauge public reaction, and they marry that in their discussion to the what's going on in the courtroom and how things shift in time. So that this is not, I mean, we had a lot of trouble when we were trying to decide, you know, which division of Cambridge University Press to send the book to, because is this a political science book or is it a law book? And it ended up in the law department, but there's an awful lot of rich material in the actual case chapters that really, you know, delves deeply into that issue.
Okay. Thank you very much. It's 8 o'clock, so I want to bring this to a close. Thank you, Ellen Lutz. Thank you, Caitlin Riga, Scott Horton, and Juan Mendez. And again, if you haven't yet purchased the book, and if they're still for sale, I hope you will acquire a copy. Thank you all for attending.
Do we sell some books for you? I hope.
I hope so. Thank you.
That woman who runs the Korean case study on Iraq.
I know. Where is she? Exactly.
Have you met people?
We actually met through a
completely separate terms.
Oh, I'm so glad that you ended up where you ended up, and that just, you know, that was... Yeah. Oh, lovely to meet you. What a great reference. Yeah, but I'm pleased that you're here, at least. Next week, well, she did. It was such so exciting to come. I think it really, like,
yeah, exactly.
The company was brilliant.
I have, no, and I have totally left my car behind as well. Yeah, do that. I've got Wendy's email, I think. Adrian.